Hello, I'm Katie Piper, and welcome to my podcast, Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. Each episode, I'll meet an amazing person with an incredible story who faced adversity and came through the other side to inspire others. Today, I'm talking to Hayley Doyle, someone who is sure to inspire you. She was involved in a barn fire at the age of 14, and she suffered severe burns as well as injuries from the smoke inhalation. We talk about dealing with the psychological aftereffects of the fire, how her burns impacted every part of her life, from work to relationships, and how she's learned to make those small steps in order to become the confident, optimistic person that she is today. Hello, Hayley.
Hi, Katie. How are you today?
I'm good. I'm good. And I'm really excited to have you here. So you're only 32 years old, yeah. And you've walked a life that most people definitely wouldn't have walked at that age and may never walk in their whole lifetime.
Yeah. So when I was 14 years old, I was involved in a rather large barn fire. Somebody set fire to it while I was unfortunately playing in the back, as children do. We'd been stacking the straw, and I got caught up in that blaze.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the countryside. We always used to go out and play in farmers' fields, play in barns. So you were totally unaware that it was on fire. You were inside.
Yeah, so it was set on fire in the front of the barn, and unfortunately I was stuck in the back, and I kind of had to go through all the, I can't remember how much straw was in the barn, but a lot of straw, having to push all the bales away and kind of jump down, and my adrenaline kicked in, and it was kind of, I've got one way to go, and it's either out that front door or I'm never getting out.
Were you the only one stuck in there, or was there a group of you?
There was a group of us in the barn, yeah, but unfortunately I was the last one out. I jumped just at the last minute before it kind of consumed me.
My goodness. And you're talking about it, you obviously remember it all then.
Oh, vividly. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think the psychological impact was the first thing that I had to really come to terms with. And obviously the physical way that I looked, I was in hospital for such a long time, and I was almost protected by the nurses and the doctors. And
how long were you in hospital?
Oh, it's quite a few months. Yeah, it was, the fire happened in September, just as I was about to go back into my fourth year of school.
My gosh,
and
right.
So it's like really a crucial time. And I lost a lot of, I mean, I had great schooling at the hospital once I was recovered enough, but I was in an induced coma because the inhalation of the smoke was quite bad, and it burnt all the inside of me.
So a lot of physical internal damage.
Yeah.
What were your injuries from this fire?
So I suffered 37% burns.
It's a large area, 37%.
Yeah. Hands, face, neck, and my waist.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
And then obviously, for anybody that doesn't understand about burns, to have that surface area of burns, the areas then that weren't burnt, you would have had to have removed as skin grafts, right?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I had to have some skin taken from my bottom.
Me too, yeah. It's all right, you're in good company. Both got scarred bums from this podcast. I mean, it's interesting because I suppose, you know, 14 is the age where we kind of go through that, who am I?
Yeah.
I mean, how does a hormonal teenager deal with the mental effect that a life-changing incident like this would have on you?
I mean, it's been one of the longest journeys that I've ever had to go on. Probably my mum and dad and my whole family's kind of gone on it with me, dealing with the psychological effect. It was awful. It was, you know, I remember sat in the hospital, and I wasn't allowed a mirror or anything, because obviously the doctors and nurses kind of have to kind of psychologically prepare you for what you're about to see. I mean, I think for the first 3, 4, 5 years of me getting out of hospital, I lived behind scarves, I lived behind woolly gloves, whether it was wind, rain, shine, you know, 30 degrees outside, and I'd be there in a woolly scarf, woolly jumper, anything zipped up in front of my chin, because that area was the most worse off, because I had braces and I had a necklace on, so they all kind of melted and embedded in my neck. So yeah, this area is quite bad from a scar perspective.
And that area of your face, it's sort of central, and it's where we communicate, and it's where, you know, we're looking at each other now. You kind of naturally look at someone's mouth when you talk to them.
Yeah, you do.
You were at the time of possibly like exploring with boys when people are having their first kiss, which that age, you get anxiety and depression anyway at that age.
you know.
Yeah, it was just completely heightened through. I mean, I remember like your friends are saying, "Oh, I can't go out because I've got a spot on my face," and it's like, wow, I would literally kill to have that spot on my face. You know, it's one of those things. But
how did you stop yourself getting angry with friends?
I think it was. I mean, don't get me wrong, I did have a lot of anger, and unfortunately my anger was something that I took out on the closest to me, i.e. my mum.
Me too, yeah.
I think with my friends, it was, they were so supportive. I mean, they used to help me wash and cream. Like,
so they were quite caring.
Yeah, they were very caring, and I think it was just a case of learning how to react in a positive way as opposed to a negative way, because the only person I'm going to end up affecting is myself.
But it's really hard to have... Like, it's easy to have that insight kind of in hindsight, isn't it? But when you're young and you're going through all those things, that's really difficult. What about the friends that were in the barn with you? How did that turn out?
Yeah, so unfortunately, it was I was on the road to recovery on my own.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was obviously legal issues with the fire, with the farmer and things that went on. So, yeah, it was... Unfortunately, I think relationships got broken down, and that was one of the main things that I really struggled with, because there wasn't anybody like you in, you know, in society who I had to look up to and understand that what I was going through was normal.
Was there particular mental health that you struggled with after what happened?
Yeah, so I suffered really bad with PTSD.
Yeah.
Hugely. And that's kind of one of the big things. Obviously, flashbacks from the fire that happened for a long time. The smell of burning. If I got a trigger smell of a burning and any type of smoke,
yeah,
I'd start panicking. Any confined...
So for anyone listening who doesn't know what PTSD is, it's post-traumatic stress, and it happens after, you know, a life-changing incident. And like you said, there's triggers where you literally, you'd go into panic attacks, I guess.
Yeah, huge. And you almost feel like you're dying, because you feel like you're suffocating, you know, your chest gets so tight and, you know, you're breathing and for a while, I mean, I had psychological help, and I'm not ashamed to say, not ashamed to admit that, because it was wonderful and it did wonders for me.
How did they help you? What did the psychologist do?
It's the acceptance, I think. So right. It's learning how to talk about it in a way that you're not reliving it.
Because that's the other thing, isn't it? We can overtalk these things and constantly relive them.
Yep.
And actually, is that helpful?
It is, I think, to a degree, but it's... I don't think straight away it's something that you should be talking about in depth, in detail. I know one of the things with me was when people ask me questions about what happened to me, and because I'm an natural extrovert, I kind of would go on a, like, waffling, and I'd start, and all of a sudden I'd be talking, and I'd be actually reliving it, you know. Whereas now I learned a technique, which was always have an answer prepared. It's just a bit, I was in a fire 15 years ago, and it kind of, not open-ended.
Yeah, so you know how to give enough information...
Without it being...
And be able to politely cut them off.
Yes.
Because it's about a boundary, isn't it?
Yeah, of course it is.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some days that I don't mind talking about it. I don't mind. And, you know, I'm a long way down my journey now, so I feel... You know,
how many years is it now for
18.
You? Oh, my goodness, it is a long time.
Yeah.
Mentally, I mean, are you still suffering or... tell me about the journey in that aspect.
Yeah, so I think it's only the last 8 to 10 years that I've actually come out of it the other side positive. I think the first 8 to 10 years was it was a horrendous journey that I went on. You know, there was times where I didn't want to get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't really want to do anything, and it was learning each day to take those tiny little steps.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, my journey. The last 8 to 10 years has been the best, I would say. I think from my work journey as well. So stepping into that workplace initially, I think I try and hide things sometimes by trying to be humorous.
Yeah, I think that's normal, like a nervous humour.
Yeah.
And like, it's a way to try and... Do you know what I think it is? Because I used to do it too. It's like to make other people feel comfortable.
Yeah.
So it's like a self-deprecating thing, isn't it? And
yeah.
At the expense of yourself, you know?
You know, early on in my career, I could be perceived as being a bit of a joker and kind of not taking things seriously, because that was the way that I coped.
Yeah.
It could all of a sudden be perceived as unprofessional, I think, in certain situations.
But the reality is, you weren't confident.
No. Not at all.
And this jokey, like, often the life and soul of the party or the person that's known for being jokey, it is to cover up, like you said, that kind of low self-esteem, I suppose.
Yeah, it's like your security blanket, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've been really lucky in terms of the confidence that I've built up. You know, it's a lot of self-confidence that I've worked on, but also other people have assisted me. You know, I think throwing yourself in at the deep end sometimes, I mean, I would absolutely freak out. But once I'd done it, it was such a huge achievement. And I think just sometimes taking that leap, you know, I think it's really important. Also, obviously, don't take a huge leap where you're going to fall and drown. But I think...
one where you're supported in a safety net.
Absolutely. And I've taken quite a few leaps now, and I'm quite confident to do that. And the elation and the feeling that I get afterwards from doing something that I wouldn't necessarily done.
Spurs you on to keep going.
Yeah.
What was the point where you were like, I don't want to be this person that has to make everyone laugh all the time and make jokes? Like, what was the defining moment where you felt like, this might be confidence for everyone else, but I'm not being real to myself. I can't live like this. This isn't true confidence.
I think the thing for me was... I do think that, say, time's a great healer. Also, time's great in terms of working on your confidence, and a little progress each day ends up in a big result.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of what it is. It's recognising what you're doing to kind of disguise those insecurities about yourself. So it's acceptance.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think once I accepted, do you know, come on, Hayley, you're being a bit of a joker here. Like, you know, people aren't taking you seriously. It's like flipping it on its head. So, you know, there's times and there's places where I should be having a joke. And it, at the end of the day, it's still me, and I'm always going to be that kind, caring, you know, lovable, kind of having a laugh person. But, yeah, it's just the progress along. It's kind of acceptance.
I think also sometimes you give a version of yourself to people that they're not necessarily even asking for. Like, people aren't necessarily asking of you to always be the one that's entertaining everybody. And you're giving that because you think that's what people want. But actually, sometimes the real you isn't so bad after all.
No.
And people are quite happy with the real you.
Yeah.
You know, and they're not expecting you to be the person that excuses your flaws and makes everything okay for them. And like, one thing I've learned is sometimes it's okay for things to be a little bit uncomfortable.
It is.
You're like, I always used to think you had to explain your appearance.
Yeah.
And you don't. Like, sometimes you can leave people wondering and you can let them do the fillers. You can let it be silent. And there's something about when you get older, knowing that an uncomfortable silence doesn't have to be that uncomfortable.
No, it doesn't. I know. I've been in that situation plenty of times. I think for years and years, especially having a physical scar, obviously mental scars, it's completely different. Again, because nobody sees them. Nobody sees what you're going through. And that, for me, the psychological scars were almost as bad as the physical scars. So I'm having to deal with the psychological effects of what I had gone through, and then I'd meet a stranger in the street, and the first... I'd just jump to conclusions and think they're looking at my scars.
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, they're not. They're probably looking at a nice necklace I've got on, or, you know, your nice top. But straight away, it's kind of that jump into conclusions, you know.
Make the
take
assumption.
A step back. Don't, always... You can become a bit of a pessimist then, can't you? And kind of always seeing the negative side of things. And that's one of the things that I worked on really hard with my confidence is the positive outlook. So rather than always, you know, like in that situation, somebody looking at me and thinking they're looking at my scars, just think, actually, no, they might be looking because I've just had my eyebrows done.
Yeah.
Or, you know,
girls
just had my hair
look at other
colour.
Girls for what shoes they're wearing. And,
And I think it's always learning how to take a compliment. I was really, really bad at taking compliments.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said, oh, I like your shoes. I'd say, oh, like 50p, you know. So I just like really put them down. And it's learning out just to say thank you. Somebody
do you know what? It's such a simple thing.
Like, it really is.
Anyone that's listening today, if somebody pays you a compliment today, try and literally just go, well, thanks very much.
Yeah.
As a British person, it's really hard.
It's really, really hard.
Because
really
you're totally hard. Right. It's so tempting to be like, if someone's like, I like your hair today, to be like, oh God, it's awful. It went wrong. And really you think, oh no, I did actually try and curl it today. Yeah. So I should just say thank you. That is about self-esteem, isn't it?
Like, of course it
saying
is.
You're allowed to be valuable and you're allowed to.
Yeah, and it doesn't come across as, you know, overconfident or, you know, pig-headed, like you say. It's just, and at the end of the day, when you've said 10 thank yous, it's all of a sudden, and you look back and reflect on the day, you remember them as well.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much you remember it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a six-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
Hey, drag fans, listen up.
I'm Alaska.
And I'm Willem.
And we are the hosts of Race Chaser, the premier RuPaul's Drag Race recap podcast. And if you aren't listening to our hit show yet, start right now.
Not to toot our own horn, but we are bona fide drag superstars. And on our award-winning podcast, we take you behind the scenes of this season and all the seasons of Drag Race to discuss and dissect the looks, the laughs, the queens, and the drama. Mama.
Race Chaser with Alaska and Willem is the ultimate backstage pass for both Drag Race obsessives and new fans alike.
No one is serving you the juicy, raw, uncut, behind-the-scenes hot goss like us, so join us.
Check out new episodes of Race Chaser every Wednesday and Friday wherever you get your podcasts.
You in the first half talked about, well, the way to build confidence is to put yourself out there and just go for it.
Yeah.
But sometimes that doesn't always end in the results we want.
No, it doesn't.
Does it?
At all. Not at all.
I'll tell one story of mine, right? It's great. It's funny now, but obviously not so funny when it's happening to you.
No.
So I remember I went out to a bar in Clapham and it was really dark at night and it was like a bar that had little tea light candles, which was massive for me to be around candles.
Yeah.
So I'm like,
oh, yeah.
So scared of candles.
Yeah.
But anyway, I did have a drunk snog in the bar in Clapham, which, you know, also secretly in my head, I was like thrilled at because it was the first kiss I'd had in like 7 years and I was like 28, I think, which obviously I didn't tell the guy, oh, guess what, I haven't kissed anyone since I was 20.
It's huge, isn't it, when you've gone through an experience like this. I think people don't realise that.
Yeah, and you just keep it secret because you don't want to like weird somebody out.
Yeah.
So the next day I'd swapped numbers with this guy and he was that guy that I'd wake up, he'd message me first being like, morning, beautiful, you know, how's your day, what are you up to? And he didn't really know like much about me. He definitely didn't know I was burnt because we met in the dark and I had a lot of makeup on. And he'd be like, oh, what are you up to today? So where do you work? And, you know, my work back then was mainly at my charity. Mm. And I was like, oh, I work for a small charity in London. And he's like, oh, is it like one I've heard of, like a cancer charity or something? And I was just like, oh, well, you won't have heard of it.
Yeah.
And he was like, yeah, but what's it called? Yeah. Like, and I was like, oh, it's called the Katie Pipe Foundation. And
can I ask you a question?
Was
that because you were feared that he'd go online and...
I feared he didn't know I had anything different
about me. Yeah, so therefore if he went online to Google the Katie Pipe Foundation and saw our images...
I think he thought he was messaging a girl who was just with blonde hair, who he'd met in a club, who led a normal life with no medical problems. And my self-esteem and confidence wasn't high enough to put it on the table and say. So I text back saying the Katie Pipe Foundation and he was like, oh my God, amazing. So do you ever actually get to meet her?
Oh, wow.
And I messaged back going, I am Katie Piper.
Yeah.
He never texts me back ever again and he blocked me on BBM.
That's awful.
So that was hard. And so for me, I was like, right, okay. I was what I would consider confident in my answer, but I didn't get the answer back I
that
wanted.
You would have expected, yeah.
So I carried on dating and it was disastrous, but I carried on and on and on. And I suppose I had to keep remembering, don't let other people's actions and the things they say and the things they do kind of be a reflection. It's not about me. Like, his reaction was about him.
Yeah.
But that was hard. But that was the affirmation I had to keep reinforcing. And I just wondered, you know, you've got some great stories about when it went right and how it helped you further your career. Did it ever go wrong putting yourself out there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I actually met my first boyfriend in the dark.
Yeah.
I met him at a nightclub.
I hate meeting people like that. It's
I know. And I think for the first 12 months of us being together, I would only ever meet him in the dark. So summertime, it was literally I would rock up to his house at like 11:30 at night because when it went dark and I'd only be there for like 5 minutes
because I'd have to be back at 11:35.
Yeah, oh yeah. But yeah, I'd always turn up drinking a Ribena because there were that
rectangle shape
to cover the scar.
To cover my face. And I'd always, every single day without fail, be turning up with an IB and a cat. And I'd have about five in my bag. I'm surprised I've got any teeth left.
Has this girl got like a major endorsement deal with Ribena? Like,
getting sponsored.
Did he ever say, like?
Yeah, so this one time I turned up, pulled my car up on his drive, and he opened the door and he just said, "Hayley, I know." And I said, "No, what?" And he just said, "I know you've got scars." And I burst into tears and I ran down the drive.
Was it tears of relief or was it tears of embarrassment?
Embarrassment.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I was embarrassed at first. And I ran down the drive and I got in my car and drove away and he was ringing and didn't answer.
Why didn't you answer? I didn't know
what to say. I didn't know. And then all of a sudden when I'd got home and I thought it's somebody that actually likes me for me, for the way I look as well.
Yeah.
So not only my personality, because I think I went through phases.
Did he say to you, so how did you find out he was okay with it then? So when you finally answered the phone...
Yeah, I mean, he just said, you know, look, I've known him for a while.
So it turns out Ribena isn't a very good disguise. No offense to anyone from Ribena.
No. Yeah. It's not after all that, after all the hard work.
Do you even like Ribena? Or were you just having to drink it?
I don't like it anymore. No. But yeah, so I was embarrassed. And to me, that was it. The relationship was over and I'd have to start. And that was... how I thought my life was going to pan out. I never thought I'd end up with anybody.
Did you have a history of sabotaging? Because you just said then all the relationship was over. Did you have a history I'll sabotage this, I'll push you away before you push me away?
And that's exactly what I did for everything. And even a friend, I wouldn't make new friends or anything because that's exactly what I did. I completely sabotaged everything. Yeah, like
I think
that was
anyone listening, you know, you don't have to have burns and scars to be kind of nodding your head right now. I think when we don't place like high worth on ourselves, we don't have high self-esteem, we're all quite guilty of sabotaging opportunity.
Yeah.
Like you said, friendship, romance, career. And I think it's fear, isn't it? Of like, I'm going to mess this up now. By choice before I get rejected further down the line.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when you have been through something life-changing, you know what it's like to really hurt, you know, being through a traumatic experience, and that pain you never want to experience again. Therefore, you will try everything in your power to not.
So somebody listening, because when you just said that then, that just gave me a stab pain in my stomach, because I can identify so much with having your world torn apart and never wanting that to happen again.
No.
And I feel like so many people, whether they're running on the treadmill right now, whether they're on the tube on the way to work, everyone knows what it's like to have your world turned upside down. And if you are going through a pattern of sabotaging, if you are walking away from opportunities because you don't have that confidence, how do you forget when it goes wrong? How do you keep building? How do you maintain that consistent confidence?
Yeah, it's...
Because you had every reason to give up. And you're here today now. You didn't give up.
No, I didn't. And my whole family's been through quite a traumatic experience. Obviously, my brother was in a really serious... Well, he was in the tsunami in Thailand and lost his leg. And we're both the same. And I think it's having that family network around you. So although you go through these, it's an episode at the end of the day. And I just think, my dad always says to me, there's always a solution to a problem. Mm-hmm. Even in your personal life, in your work, everything, there's always going to be a solution. So, you know what, Hayley, you're having a little blip now, but it will be solved and we'll get over it and we'll come out the other side. And I think that's kind of like, once you recognise the pattern that you are going, you know, the path that you're going on and these patterns that you're developing, as soon as you recognise it, it's really easy to accept it and kind of challenge them as...
I think you're so right. And I think a lot of people will be annoyed at me for saying this, but I think... confidence is a question.
Yeah.
And it's actually one that does take us to do a lot of soul searching of really how confident do you want to be?
Yeah.
Because the choice lays in your hands.
You.
It does. It really does lay with you. And I know that annoys some people because they say, well, X, Y, Z happened to me, or you've got this life and I don't have that life. But still, we make a choice of how confident we want to be, and we make a choice of how much we want external factors to influence that level of confidence.
Absolutely.
So if people don't fancy us or if we don't get the job, do we let that destroy our confidence? The answer lies with us.
You.
It does. So we've had some people emailing in
We've got somebody that's emailed in here, Priscilla. She says, our son Nathaniel has had 4 open heart surgeries. My goodness. It was a very long journey. Yeah, I mean, that in itself, that's a huge, huge journey. One step forward, 2 steps back, a massive roller coaster. Now he's currently at school. He started to get a complex about this huge scar going down his chest, even though I'm constantly kissing it and telling him how beautiful it is. So my question is, if anyone else has gone through this, how can I grow his confidence? He is amazing at what he's gone through, but as many times as we thought he wasn't going to make it through. I believe in positive energy, but this doesn't seem to be helping. I hope you can help. Regards, Priscilla. Well, I think actually this isn't just about Nathaniel. I think this may be about his mum as well.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like he's a real strong boy.
Yeah, a real warrior by the sounds of it.
Yeah, to go through all of this, and he's back at school, he's among his peer group. And I don't know if you have seen this with your mum. Sometimes, you know, it's as hard, if not harder, for those supporting you.
It is, because they're the ones that have to see, you know, like when I say when I was in the induced coma, and I know you were in the same situation, weren't you? I think, and obviously Nathaniel will be, you know, he'll be having to be in surgery, and so your parents are seeing you when you're out of it, you're not.
They've got worse visual memories than you have, because you're oblivious.
Absolutely, and I think sometimes your parents go through it just the same as, obviously they don't experience the pain,
mm-hmm.
but they experience pain in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're helpless, and I think, you know, my mum and dad experienced the same thing, and I think once they did meet people through your charity, actually, and parents that are going through the same thing, it really, really helps heal.
Yeah, I think, do you know what? I think that's a really good point. And Priscilla, maybe you would benefit actually possibly from going online and finding other parents that have been through this, because sometimes I know now I've become a mum, we're full of anxieties for our children and we want them to have the best start in life. And actually, in every child's life, scar or no scar, there will be some bullying, some competitiveness, and that is the nature. But of course, we want to protect our children. But all we can do is equip them with a good level of identity, a sense of self and who they are, so that they can cope and deal with that. But I think there's a really good affirmation, and I'm going to get it wrong. It's something about those that don't mind matter and those that mind don't matter, or something.
Those that mind don't matter and those... Oh, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I know which
basically
one
it's saying that, you know, like our dating stories, the people that do have a problem with our scars, Nathaniel's scars, aren't the people that you want to seek out in your life anyway. We've had a really nice email in from Tony. It says, hi, Katie, I've been a midwife since 2006 when I qualified. I then had my third daughter in February 2009 and I suffered severe postnatal depression for years afterwards. I had to leave my job for a while whilst I got better. And even now, I struggle day to day. But thankfully, I am now back working as a midwife again. Kind regards, Tony. Do you know what? I love that, because that's all about being grateful, isn't it? And actually, she's acknowledging it's been a long time, a hideous time with depression. And she said even now she still struggles. And that is mental health, isn't it? It's not like you get better and it's gone.
No, and I think there's a stigma attached as well, isn't there? Sometimes it's kind of, oh, you're not depressed, you know, like, you know, pull yourself together.
I hate it. Cheer up.
Yeah, it's like, really?
Yeah.
If you only knew what it was like to live with it, just walk a day in their shoes sometimes, and in my shoes, it's like, you don't understand. But also, I think the acceptance as well, I think the fact that she's accepted what she's going through and she's learning how to...
And she's practising gratitude. She's saying, I do still struggle day to day with depression, but thankfully I'm back at work. So she's grateful for the positives.
Yeah, absolutely.
But she's real about her struggle. Do you still have daily struggles?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'd be lying if I said I woke up every day and every day was, you know... morning, you know,
like, God, that would be an annoying person.
Oh, wow, yeah. I do go through, I mean, a lot of good days as opposed to bad days, but when I do have those bad days, and it's kind of like, it's a real struggle to get yourself out of bed, to kind of motivate yourself, but like I said, I mean, I'm surrounded by great people, and I think over the years, it's taken a long time to understand what post-traumatic stress disorder actually is. People don't just understand what it is overnight, especially your family network. And I think, you know, it's taken a lot of time, but they really do assist with that.
Yeah. I think one thing, a sort of final thought I wanted to leave everyone with about confidence is we all document when things are good. So on social media, we always put when we're happy, when we've got the job, when we look good, when we've got nice hair.
We
always document when it goes right. And one of the things I did on my confidence journey is I documented the really crap days in a private diary of when things went wrong, things I did wrong, when I felt awful, the days I couldn't get out of bed. And then that diary helped me see that last week was not even just seven bad days. It was like seven bad days with four bad episodes in that day.
Yeah.
And then when I kept writing it and writing it, I was like, oh, this week was actually only five bad days. And then it reduced and it reduced where there weren't even bad days, there were bad moments. Mm. And I was able to see that ratio.
That's such a good piece of advice.
It's really simple. I still do it now.
It's amazing.
Because all it is perspective.
Of course it is.
Yeah. And it's okay. And some weeks are really bad still, but that's just like really normal. Imagine if we all shared that honest journal like that on Instagram. That would normalise it.
And it would. And I think that sometimes the power of social media is great for a lot of things, but also, like you say, it can kind of put a not so true slant on the world we live in, doesn't it, sometimes?
It really does. So anybody that's struggling with confidence, I'd like you to keep an honest confidence journal. And I'd like you to remember Hayley. You've got a very memorable voice. I love your accent, Mancunian accent. It's one of my favourite accents.
Really?
But I'd like you
just
to...
Just saying that.
No, I'm not. See, true confidence. I'm giving you a compliment.
Oh, thank you.
Exactly. I'd like you to remember 14-year-old Hayley that was burnt in a barn fire and spent all that time in hospital, who now is the 32-year-old Hayley sat opposite me talking about these experiences and making a success of her life. Every time you doubt yourself, every time you're scared to put yourself forward, think about what Hayley did. Thank you so much for sharing your
story. Thank you very much for having me, and thank you everyone for listening.
Thank you everybody who's tuned in, and we will see you next week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. If you haven't already, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Next week, I'm talking to Kelly Knox, a model and activist who was born without her left forearm. She's passionate about using her platform to change society's perception of people with visible differences and has incredible resilience and strength. I can't wait for you to meet her. If you enjoyed this, please help us spread the word. Rate and review the show where you got this, or share on socials.